people will stay longer in a community that is easy to leave. In such communities, settlers will take pride in their homes and gardens and establish strong bonds with their friends and neighbors. Dependable fellow citizens who are anxious to put down roots in the community of which they are newly a part. It is for this reason that roads and railway development that play such a major part in government policy of development in British Columbia during the past 7 years. And if I may observe, the success of this policy has been during this time to roll back our frontier and to lift our mental horizon several hundreds of miles to the north of our province. The size of northern road development in British Columbia is of immense importance to the state of Alaska. As this development, it may be observed immediately that the time and location of new northern routes in British Columbia take into account not only existing settlements of people, but perhaps more importantly in the long run, the location of resources which will permit people to settle in communities at least as sparsely as those already in existence. Northern road development in British Columbia is therefore to a large extent resource-based and located. In consideration of this fact, the existing Alaska Highway is going to play an important part in northern development in our province for many years to come. For one thing, it traverses one of the most important gas and oil fields in North America and is proving of immense value to oil exploration companies in the field because it supplies access, permanent access. It is also a logical jumping off point for further resource road development. For example, we are thinking the federal government of Canada to join with the province of British Columbia to construct a road between St. Nelson and St. Simpson in the Northwest Territory. Although our partnership offer in this connection has not so far come to realization, it is apparent to us in the province that the immense importance of reaching our Canadian North is going to produce a favorable answer from our federal government in due course in relation to their policy of roads to resort. As everyone has mentioned, the Alaska Highway, not only in terms of its economic importance, but also in the contribution which it makes to the strategic security of the state of Alaska, I'm bound at the same time to say that any new land link from the 49th parallel to the 49th state will very certainly take a more direct route than the existing Alaska Highway. In fact, it may be foreseen that the existing British Columbia section may be bypassed when certain northern roads in our province already under planning and one day to be under construction or completed. In this connection, one of the most comprehensive resource surveys that has been conducted within the province is now being carried out by one of them, British Columbia Development Company Limited. This private company has spent nearly $6 million on an intensive study of a large section of the province centering around the Rocky Mountain Fence region of the Peace River system. From information already obtained, it is distinctly possible that this survey may recommend the construction of a railway in a northwesterly direction from St. George, eventually extending through the Yukon to Alaska. Well, such a line would be of immense value to the 49th state and the Yukon by providing the facilities for heavy freight movement both to and from the peninsula and the rest of the continent. In addition to the anticipated possibility of rail development, the provincial government has already begun the construction of a road that could be of considerable importance to Alaska, particularly the Alaska Panhandle. With no problems or long connection, the Panhandle is presently dependent entirely upon air transportation and greatly reduced steamship services. Consequently, the need for such other assets cannot be overlooked. A couple years ago, a large high-grade deposit of asbestos was staked at South Yard. This deposit of asbestos has since been extensively developed by using the Alaska Highway and the West Boston Yukon Railway. However, this circuitous route has proved very costly, and only the higher grades of asbestos are shipped with profit. It is believed that this situation would be greatly improved if an outlet was constructed south from the mine to Still City, Columbia. This route is now under construction and is known as the Still City Road. In the construction of this battle link, about $3 million per year are being expended. And I may say, with the cooperation and assistance of our friends in the national government. The time for completion of the Steel Sapphire Road is 1963, and the southern end will be connected with the Trans-Provincial Highway, which runs between Prince Rupert and Prince George. If a link could be built between this road and Portland, British Columbia, it would result in a route roughly paralleling the Panhandle and extending its entire length. This link would provide a connection between the Alaska Highway in the north directly to the Trans-Provincial Highway number 16, which I have just mentioned. The relatively isolated communities of the Panhandle could be directly connected to the main British Columbia trunk by access roads constructed down the river valleys that penetrate the boundary ranges. This would, of course, provide long overdue outlets, which the communities in your state so desperately need. You know, being on the main line would be directly connected, but of course, Fango and Petersburg would need auxiliary ferry service. And in addition, such a town would probably require a road to the north end of the island. No doubt these access roads would be very useful for moving some of the mine products out to town rather, with considerable benefit to the ports and docks. However, I would say that the development in this direction is not entirely obvious by reason of buried problems of Canadian and American development. I must be frank to say this problem is in many instances complicated by channel structures which impede the Canadian development from our side of the boundary. The government through the governor this morning mentioned the road to resort its policy as presenting an opportunity for joint action. And of course, I agree with that statement as far as it goes. But I would also observe in that connection that the resources which the Western through the governor's state know no boundaries and do encounter tariff boundaries on their way to their natural market. And some consideration of this basic economic fact has to be taken into account when considering a joint action for the development of internationally situated resources in this region. Now, I say in a completely friendly way that the community is concerned, of course, that these problems would be eliminated entirely if they would be such to the province of British Columbia. At the same point of northern industrial development, the economic significance of this link, which we have just been discussing, becomes obvious because the link connects the Coast Range Batholith in a region which the geologists believe to be richly mineralized. It would thus be of great aid in exploring and developing this area. It would as well provide a permanent access to a number of known hydroelectric sites on several river systems. Engineering studies show that the potential of the area immediately adjoining the Panhandle in Canada of a hydroelectric development range up to 6 million horsepower. Utilization of any of the major sites would probably result in the generation of a considerable power surplus, available for the general development of northern British Columbia, Yukon Territory, and possibly Alaska this time. From the standpoint of gas and air, the such a hiding link would also serve an area to the east known as the Groundhog Basin. A major oil interest have recently been granted permission to explore this basin, and the transportation facilities of the Pure Caspian Road and any link which may be ultimately constructed to happen will be of great assistance to this new center of development. Another sign of northern linkage, which is in the early stages of consideration in British Columbia, involves the completion of the main highway on Vancouver Island, north from Courtney and Tambo River to Fort Hardy. Fort Hardy's a bendy link, which could amount by ferry, and thus follows the trunk line which we have been discussing north into Fairbanks. This would cut the distance between Fairbanks and Seattle to about 1,900 miles, of which 225 miles would be by ferry. The present distance between these two points by way of the Alaska Highway and Prince George is about 2,400 miles. So clearly, we feel that the northern industrial development, and indeed the general industrial development of British Columbia, is linked with roadway systems, but it has been the immense policy of the government of British Columbia that road construction will involve the expenditure of about $1,000 million over the next 10 years. A significant percentage of this amount will of course be allocated to the northern section for the reasons which I have just been discussing. Not only will this expenditure have significance for British Columbia, but it will also have considerable beneficial impact upon the state of Alaska. We are conscious too, of course, that the development of Alaska can equally benefit the province of British Columbia, more particularly its northern region. And it is on this account that I would indicate most sincerely on behalf of the government of British Columbia that plans for the mutual development of our northern regions and Alaska will be most welcome and be given every consideration. To assist your appreciation of what we think is going to happen in the north, a small map showing some of the suggested overlying routes which may traverse northern British Columbia has been prepared, and I understand has been already distributed to you. The key to the comments which I may make in this connection is contained in the numbers which are fixed alongside certain of these routes. I'm afraid the numbering is not as clear as it might be. If you will notice numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 indicating certain routes which I will identify in my remarks as I go along. There have been at least 6 routes suggested by British Columbia's land bridge to Alaska. 5 of these are depicted on the map which you have. The 6th, which involves the Rocky Mountain fence, may be rendered impracticable when the fence is flooded by the Peace River power project. The 6th route between Seattle and Fairbanks would involve approximately 2,000 miles of travel. Consequently, there is no great mileage saving over the other alternatives, but would probably have some advantage based on lower gradient and less temperature if a rail were being considered in that connection. I wish now to comment first on route number 1. Route number 1 on the map is perhaps the most interesting, and the one which has not been considered too seriously in the past. And it involves, as I said a few moments ago, the completion of the island highway to Fort Hardy at the north end of Vancouver Island and a car ferry to Kitimat. By the Caspian Road to the vicinity of the Stikine Canyon and on through Atlin to the Alaska Highway south of Whitehorse. This route involves about 1,900 miles of travel between Seattle and Fairbanks, of which 225 miles is by car ferry. And this compares in distance with inland route number 3, and serves the spur road through the coast range linking Ketchikan to the main highway system, which route number 3, however, does not do. Route number 2 and 2A, roughly 2,100 and 2,250 miles, respectively, between Seattle and Fairbanks, is somewhat longer but would not involve a car ferry and would serve the Ketchikan spur. Route 2A is included to show an intermediate step which would be taken by utilizing the existing Chatsuyar Road all the way to the Alaska Highway near Watson Lake. Similarly, Route 3A is included for the same purpose. It may be noted that the figures which are set out on the map are rounded to the closest 50 miles, and although great care has been exercised in map appreciation of these routes from the details available to our engineers, a closer analysis would be suspicious because actual engineering and location studies have yet to be done. Route number 3, because of overburden and other factors, serves the most highly mineralized regions between the east and the west, but is one of the most direct routes to Alaska proper. In common with Route 4, it would not serve such time. A route indicated as number 4 is probably the most economic, insofar as rail traffic potential is concerned. It goes through more highly forested and mineralized territory and is not as vulnerable as the more westerly route to ocean competition. However, engineering investigation may change this proposed route considerably in the near future. Route indicated as number 5 is the existing highway route between Seattle and Fairbanks and involves the Pacific Highway, the Trans-Canada Highway, the Chatsuyar Road, and the John Hart Highway and the Alaska Highway itself. That distance exceeds 2,400 miles. From this very hurried survey, it can be seen that the Chatsuyar Road, which we hope to have completed by 1963, will play an important role in the land bridge to Alaska, and that a connection between the Stickeen Canyon area and Appen, that spur road through to the principal town animal community, appears to be the next logical step. All the alternatives, except those indicated as 2A and 3A, prevent a saving of at least 300 miles over the present route, or the equivalent roughly of a day's travel on the Alaska Highway itself. We have indicated informally in connection with this map a table giving preliminary estimates of the annual traffic which each of these routes might carry. And I may say that our Bureau of Economics and Statistics will be able to arrive at more comprehensive figures once we have had the benefit of the reverse surveys conducted by the Winogrand Development Company and by the Bashar Memorial Institute, which is engaged by the Alaska International Rail and Highway Commission. Along with this map and the accompanying traffic figures, I've had this figure of a smaller one showing the two regions in British Columbia north, north of the 54th parallel, that is, that are believed to have the highest load mineral potential within our jurisdiction. It has been tentatively estimated that if these two regions were made fully accessible, and here I come back to the basic requirement of permanent access, the western section could produce 135,000 tons and the eastern section about 155,000 tons a year, say for 40 years, of mine concentrate, chiefly copper, zinc, and lead. I want to be fair to say that these estimates are based upon an assumption that favorable market conditions will exist in that period, and the production would be in proportion to past production in acceptable territories with which we have had experience. And I want to say, so that I'm completely understood, that American tariff policy bears directly upon our prospects in this region. You will have received this guide, a map entitled Hydroelectric Power Resources in British Columbia, from which you will note that in the northwest sector of our province, we have indicated a defined total potential of 4,900,000 horsepower, which would be considerably increased by the construction of additional dam sites downstream in the Yukon Territory and, of course, in Alaska itself. The full extent of this resource is as yet unknown to us. From our experience in northern development of British Columbia, I have therefore drawn certain broad conclusions which I hope you will accept as being approximately valid. First, stated earlier in my remarks that development depends upon usable resources in world demand. To this end, an economic study under the authority of the International Rail and Highway Commission to pinpoint resource location has been already commenced. I wish to assure the people of Alaska that we are cooperating fully with the Battelle Institute, which is undertaking this important survey, and furnishing data from our official file to make this study of the utmost importance to the Pacific Northwest, to Alaska, and we hope to ourselves. The second step, which I have emphasized, is the provision of access by road and by rail to regions of discovered usable resources. The discovery of resources and the provision of access lead quickly to the orderly and economic development of money and the widespread settlement of people. My appreciation of the problem of economic development of the state of Alaska is that the steps to be followed are entirely those which have occurred in British Columbia. Because our problems are parallel in all instances, the growth which is bound to occur in Alaska is obviously going to make our Northland and British Columbia more attractive. And the growth which is taking place in the Northland of British Columbia, particularly in the provision of access to regions rich in resources which we intend to develop, is inevitably going to provide a part of the answer which Alaska is seeking, namely that of improved land connection by road and by rail to the 49th parallel. To the extent, therefore, that the populations of British Columbia, let me put it this way, to a greater extent than our people realize in either jurisdiction, our problems are not only parallel, but these problems, once overcome, become complementary to the portions of the adjoining region. And for these general reasons, and for the joy evident among our American neighbors upon the attainment of status, we wholeheartedly congratulate those in the state of Alaska upon the attainment of status. We wish to record our warmest wishes for the good fortune to attend the future of this state. And I want to assure you, Mr. Governor, that we extend with these warm wishes a willingness as well to cooperate for our mutual and lasting benefit. Ladies and gentlemen, you recently heard Mayor Hagman attempt to return you to all that, it was just the first fall steel plant around the coast. The old FS unit. And finally, transfer service to us, the last of that. I'm sure that your body is not all the story about John, but if I traveled around through Alaska, I've seen a great many of our guns still used, and we're using a great many other services to hand them over. Under on, people from our company were on hand to service the first truck rolled into Alaska in the early 1920. And we see the first aeromail flight here in 1924. Saturday, as we call ourselves and the family, they're going to become a part of the territory and then of the new state. First, Bob Perkins here in the audience this morning, our manager here in Fairbanks, born and raised in Alaska, as were many of our country employees in the zone. Young geologist, the head of our exploration office in Anchorage, is the second generation of his family to hunt whales in Alaska. We've been looking for whales for a long, long time. Well, you can see that we have many good reasons to share Alaskans and seagulls in about people. This time, I also want to extend a very warm greeting to our good friends from Canada. We are part of this association, and we are represented here today. The Canadian West, no less than Alaska, has been, and it is of major importance to the petroleum industry. Not to mention the strategic importance of both of these areas to the people of the North American continent. The oil industry of the Canadian West, in fact, has passed through the stage of development that Alaska's oil may one day, and we hope soon, be appropriate. So if it's possible and practical to maintain this close tie between the two countries and to exchange freely our knowledge and our experience, as we are doing this evening. In a broad sense, the Canadian experience in oil provides us the same system in which to draw certain general conclusions about Alaska for our future. All exploration and development have been going on in Canada for more than a half a century. But the modern Canadian oil industry is relatively new. The very principle of its most important commercial development is concerned from the discovery of oil of the Dutch in central Alberta in February of 1947. That discovery climaxed an often discouraging search that had been cut off by the discovery of Treasure Valley field in southwest Alberta some 11 years earlier. In that 11 years, more than $100 million was invested by the oil industry in Canadian exploration. And one can only speculate how much longer the search would have gone on if the Dutch hadn't come along to revitalize industry hope. Now 12 years and some $4.5 billion later in expenditures, the oil industry ranked first among Canada's mineral producers. And last year produced oil and gas valued at more than $400 million. According to estimates of the Canadian Petroleum Association, 3/3 of crude oil and other liquid cut petroleum stood at more than 3,600,000,000 barrels. And despite the production of more than 1 billion barrels of oil since 1947, natural gas reserves were over 23 trillion cubic feet, nearly 30 times greater. Canada's industry today is capable of producing 50 times as much oil as it was able to produce only 12 years ago. It has spun one of the greatest pipeline systems in the whole world, first 5,100 miles of crude oil and product line, and 6,500 miles of natural gas line. Canadians are the world's best customers for oil. So we are the second highest consumer of petroleum in the world, and as a nation, the third largest consumer of oil. 1947, Canadian refineries are fast being stripped. 800,000 barrels saved. But only just enough to keep ahead of Canada's own demand. The discovery of the Duck sparked a widespread exploration program that continues vigorously today. There are better remains in the forefront of Canadian air, developing the French Panama through the provinces of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and more recently to British Columbia. British Columbia has been fortunate in finding within its borders what seems to be one of the world's great sources of natural gas. When the West Coast transmission line was completed in 1957, this gas became available in the United States market, and interest in British Columbia's oil and gas development has been stepped up to a point. Our friends from British Columbia who are here today can confirm that this development has had a very healthy economic impact and promise to have more in the future. By way of an example, the relatively young oil and gas industry of British Columbia has generated more than $30 million in royalties and fees since the first gas well was brought in 1951. The first expansion of Canada's oil and gas production has not been without its attendant growing pains. So rapidly has Canadian production been opened up in the Prairie provinces and British Columbia, that the market has simply not grown fast enough to absorb all of the productive capacity. At the outset of 1959, Canadian oil production was 549,000 barrels per day, about 54% of the actual million barrel a day potential. This has disappointed some people. We hope for a much more rapid absorption of Canadian oil in the marketplace. This result in greater benefits to Mr. Canada's economy as a whole. To this, I can only offer a consolation that the oil industry everywhere shares this disappointment. For every oil producing nation in the world today would like to be selling more of its oil. This is true of the United States. Of Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Damascus, and all the others are producing gas. But the market simply isn't there yet. The world's productive capacity for the moment has outstripped the ability of people to consume oil of the oil that could be brought up out of the ground. Historically, this isn't anything to do. We've been through the cycle of oversupply before, just as we've been through the cycles of undersupply. In each instance, dire predictions have been made about the future of the oil industry. Either that it would run out of oil, or that it would drown itself economically in the surfeit of unneeded and unwanted inventory. But in every instance, the scale was swung back in the balance. And found the customers, and the oil industry has moved ahead to new heights of production and demand, just as it will do again. Canada will certainly enjoy its proper share of the new markets that are and will eventually open up. For the time being, we have, as I say, a situation in which potential production exceeds the world's capacity for consumption. We have two basic alternatives for coping with it. The oil-producing nations of the world can ignore the market realities and produce the capacity, or they can bide their time, sensibly gearing production to the level which can be reasonably explored. Leading the way for Canada, Alberta has wisely adopted the latter approach by establishing a system of prorated production. As was done earlier in our own state of Texas and in some of the other states in our United States. This approach to the problem of overcapacity is good, The sensible recorder will be protected from wasteful exploitation. That's the only thing that gets justified that kind of program. If the virus preserves the Canadian oil in the ground, today it has a potential value in the billions of dollars. But only if they can be marketed, and prices are fairly reflect the cost of finding oil, and which encourage further exploration and development. Were these reserves to be produced at a rate higher than the market could afford, the potential value to Canadians would be largely lost for all time. Additionally, such wasteful production would be bound to have a depressing effect on exploratory activity and result in diminishing reserves for the future. Notwithstanding the frustrations encountered in marketing growing production, the oil industry in Canada and the other major oil producing countries can take some comfort in the demand prospects which have been forecast for the next 10 or 15 years. As you may know, our company and its affiliates engage in the oil business on a worldwide scale. To do this successfully, we have to look far ahead in appraising market prospects. Not merely the next year, but well beyond the next decade and more. Our present thinking about these prospects is decidedly on the favorable side. For North America, our economists are forecasting an increase in petroleum demand from the present level of 10 billion barrels of oil daily to 17 million barrels a day. Consumption in 1975, from 15 years away. For the free world as a whole, I foresee an increase from approximately 18 million barrels a day this year to more than 37 million barrels daily in 1975. My mind has a few is supported by other economists at the recent World Petroleum Congress, that's held in New York. These sizable increases in demand would be sufficient to absorb most of the excess capacity, which exists today in Canada and elsewhere. And finally, confidence of the petroleum industry in the future of Canadian oil can best be demonstrated, I believe, by calling your attention to the amount of exploratory effort going on right now in Canada. Exploration parties are ranging as far as the Northwest Territory and a good way beyond that. Prospects for any oil development in the near future, as a result of research in the far north, are probably remote. Developments within the last week would seem to indicate there may not be as remote as some people have thought. But such exploration must begin now, years ahead of the actual need, if our increased oil requirements are to be met when we do arrive. An account of this experience in oil development, while only loosely serving as a model for level action could expect, does amply demonstrate the conclusion that such development is costly and is fraught with problems. The word oil strike, at least for a decade or more, are not necessarily synonyms to the prosperity and unmixed blessing for everybody. Nevertheless, I suspect that you will ask me, is that the oil areas of the kind of problems of oil strikes that are now plaguing your Canadian nation? I can assure you that the oil industry is doing its best to see the suggestion. In many opinions here of Alaska's economic future, oil must be considered as one of the important factors, and I'd like to turn now to that subject. As we know, a sufficient volume of oil in Alaska would go a long way toward meeting the fiscal needs of the state, providing a sound economic base. Long-term growth in most fields of activity. Today, we are considerably closer to our goal of an oil-producing industry in Alaska than we have been at any time in history. And in that first part of the ledger, we have the geologic time code, a point for promising growth producing problems. Or we have the debit card, with which all of us are uncomfortably familiar. Nature is jealous of its treasures, and as resisted by every trick of climate and terrain, most of our efforts to locate oil, we believe, exist beneath our Alaska's surface. The risk likely to be encountered in Alaska oil development are not for the faint hearted, or for the speculators of the shallow pool. We recently witnessed the suspension of operations at Barrister. The one oil company repeatedly sank many millions of dollars into its well before falling in the bay. This makes our $2 million worth of dry holes on the Johnson River unit and a deep rip look like flood. The magnitude of this gamble is well known to the oil industry. It's perhaps revealing that many of our company's budget and wealthy affair companies have no operations in Alaska at all. Preferring to save their hunting money for their patient figures, they have credible time. Jobs in this gamble, moreover, will go longer if the industry moves into offshore drilling and cooking it in the months to come. Once over water, the cost of putting down a well can multiply alarmingly. As we have already seen in our own Gulf of Mexico, where, despite all the publicity and favorable things to be said about the profitability and the great amount of oil that's been found in the Gulf, the industry is still very much in the red. All of these risk factors and the privacy taken into account in the planning of exploratory operations in Alaska. We do not discourage us from seeking the possible reward that would come from a substantial development of oil in this state. Alaska and the neighboring Canadian West, which I have discussed, constitute the last frontier for oil exploration in North America. I see the little slogan on our program is no longer a frontier, but it's still the last real frontier that the industry has here in North America. The more that we can find and develop oil resources in these areas, the more we can strengthen the productive capacity of our oil industry, our economy, and the military might of our two key nations. That's why, despite the disappointment and the hardship, the risks are worthwhile. When I was preparing to make this little talk a few weeks ago, I spent an evening reading through some of Ernest Green's writing from Alaska. You may remember in his book, The State of Alaska, he breaks down the historical truth into what he terms the earth of total and fragments of flesh, of mild but unenlightened temper, and brings him on to an era of growing awareness to the first. The second I might categorize is the eerie of great expectation. Within a relatively short span of time, Alaska has achieved the pinnacle of full commercial status and has experienced its first commercial oil crisis. Either development by itself would have been enough to embolden Alaskans about the future, and together these events form a combination that must rise high, the spirit of all but the most generous. How well and how soon are Alaska's great expectations to be realized? Endless speculation has been devoted to that question. Much of it linking the future of Alaska intimately with the future of its oil. So let me review here how far this oil development has come along, so that we may try to estimate how far it has yet to go. More than 2 years have passed now, since the Richfield Oil Corporation, Johnson River Unit Number 1, ushered in this new era in Alaska oil development. And after that event, determined to face reality. I've actually three extremely successful wells on the Johnson River Union, which currently be about 615 barrels a day. Incidentally, that's about as much oil as Cuba, or the nation of Cuba is producing. This is about all that we are able to handle under the circumstances of cutting the oil with steel. Notably shipping that oil to our refined district in California. I know you'll be interested in oil, but we're studying various plans for constructing a pipeline to move Johnson River oil to Tidewater. And that move seems to be justified economically. The most practical of these plans seems to be a line from Johnson River over to the Second Lake Star. This is the shortest path to the rock.
Prohibiting exploration
You know, we used to see some wildlife about it. One which comes most readily to mind is the semi-national reef swimming, within which is located the Santa River Unit. The fact of the part of this reserve remains still to be a physical study, and one can do little more than speculate on the potential of this land. But while so close, the last is only commercial production. Our company is wholly in accord with the concept of wildlife preservation. And let me stress that we practice this as well as we talk about it. Our crews in the field are instructed to operate in a manner which will not disrupt the normal course of events in wildlife areas. We've done this on the Canary Princess Peninsula, and I can tell you from first-hand experience of our people that Ford Gifford between me and all of my army is entirely feasible. And after this experience, I'm hopeful that the rest of the new swing, another area of similar oil potential, will ultimately be opened up to our exploration. I think it would be fair if any potentially productive area in Alaska were left untouched, and all production in the state is so badly needed. I'm totally convinced that all such areas could be examined without harm to the resident wildlife by responsible companies which are ready and are quite willing to take the special pains that are necessary. I might also mention, in connection with this matter, that we of the agency here in Alaska and elsewhere have been deeply disturbed by the implications of this wilderness bill, which has been pending in Congress. This bill would require higher salaries in Alaska and further prospecting. When what is needed from the standpoint of oil development is quite the opposite. I'm sure most Alaskans agree with me, and the exemption of Alaska area from this bill is not. The exemption of Alaska areas from this deal is entirely in order. While we are not concerned with the effect of this deal elsewhere and here in Alaska, it seems to me that the whole idea of feeding off wilderness areas from human intrusion is a subject of strict where critical examination is needed. Our industry and others have demonstrated that multiple uses of wilderness land is practical and provides the maximum benefit to society. And I fail to see how we can be better off as a people by denying ourselves access to potentially rich deposits of oil and other minerals when they can be produced without harm to the land itself. Before I leave this general subject of government role in Alaska tomorrow, I want to give appropriate credit to Senator Buck for his keen understanding of the oil depletion issue. You remember the very recent sessions of Congress. There's been a determined effort by some Congressmen to reduce or eliminate the power of the percentage depletion tax provision, which is a direct, by far the most direct and important stimulus to exploratory activity. Senator Bartlett, from the beginning, recognized the importance of this provision in the state's budding oil industry, and he continued to support it vigorously. At such a time as Alaska's oil industry reaches the possible point of development, we all hope it will. Senator Bartlett can justly claim his share of the credit. Gentlemen, that's very hard about my views on the last report. Views which many of us in the oil industry concur with most. What we see is a picture spotted by passing fathers and our past faith, but illuminated by cautious hope. It's a rapidly changing picture as a result of wells being drilled at this very moment, modify the plans that are being made for the land. I wish it were possible for me to be wholly optimistic about this picture. But you, I'm sure as I, are a realistic businessman, and I'm sure you want no part of full confidence. I can say this, and say it with complete confidence. We of the petroleum industry
Thank you.